From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and several media outlets are reporting today that President-elect Donald Trump is expected to name Andy Puzder, the CEO of CKE Holdings, to be his labor secretary. NPR has not yet confirmed that. CKE Holdings runs the Carl's Jr. and Hardee's burger chains, and Puzder is a critic of raising the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour, as some fast food workers would like. Meanwhile, some more of Trump's tweets are getting attention, and joining us now to talk about all of this is Domenico Montanaro, politics editor at NPR. Hi, Domenico.
Hello, Jeremy.
And first of all, what more can you tell us about Andy Puzder?
Well, you know, you mentioned a little bit about him being the CEO that kind of oversees Hardee's and Carl's Jr., the fast food advocate, fast food chain. He's criticized the Affordable Care Act. You noted that he was against raising the minimum wage really above anything over $9 an hour. And while all this could mean that he could roll back some of the Obama regulations when you think about things like overtime pay, workplace safety, corporate accountability, there was even one effort to try to get a little bit more transparency on union busting tactics within organizations. Most of or all of that will either not be enforced very heavily or rolled back, you would expect.
I also saw that he had written a piece in the Wall Street Journal along with Stephen Moore, the conservative economist, saying, "We believe that deporting 11 million people is unworkable, and we hope in the end Mr. Trump comes to the same conclusion." Mm-hmm. I wonder if Trump supporters are going to like to hear that and the issue of the $15 minimum wage. Is he going to face any pushback from Trump's most vocal supporters?
I doubt it. I mean, I think that the big thing with him, if you think about a lot of the cities around the country that have tried to do things like, restricting the size of soft drinks when New York tried to do it, for example, other cities, San Francisco, whatever. This is the kind of thing that he has said stifles growth. So I don't think that what he is, may have said when it comes to immigration is really going to have any kind of impact on the supporters that, support Trump. They would just see him as somebody who wants to expand business. But what I think is really key for our listeners to understand is now you're starting, as you see the cabinet take shape, you're going to have a very pro-oil, pro-fast food, anti-regulations administration that's coming in.
And a lot of multimillionaires as well. Let's talk about what happened last night on television. And I'm not talking about Hairspray Live, which apparently Trump wasn't watching, but rather CNN, where Chuck Jones, who's the head of the local steelworkers union at Carrier Corporation in Indianapolis, said that Trump had, quote, lied his ass off about how many Carrier jobs he saved in a deal announced last week. Here's Jones on CNN.
Well, I want to say this, first of all. I appreciate Mr. Trump getting involved and saving as many people's livelihoods as he did. So I don't think that can go without being said. I just wish that he'd have had the numbers down and he'd have been.
So Trump was watching that and he tweeted out, "Chuck Jones, who is president of United Steelworkers 1999, has done a terrible job representing workers. No wonder companies flee country." And then Jones said that within a half an hour, he had started getting threatening phone calls from Trump supporters. And then on CNN, former Bill Clinton Labor Secretary Robert Reich made a direct appeal to Trump. This was fascinating to watch. Let's listen to an extended portion.
"With all due respect, Mr. Trump, you are president-elect of the United States. You are looking and acting as if you are mean and petty, thin-skinned, and vindictive. Stop this. This is not a fireside chat. This is not what FDR did. This isn't lifting people up. This is actually penalizing people for speaking their minds. What you did with Boeing the other day, minutes after the CEO of Boeing was quoted as saying that you, Mr. Trump, you, President-elect Trump, were wrong on international trade, what did you do? You tweeted that Boeing should have an order canceled. Well, you called it a $4 billion order. And that meant Boeing's own prices, its share prices, plummeted. So in other words, what you, Mr. Trump, what you would like is for no one, not a CEO, nobody on television, no journalist, nobody to criticize you. You take offense at that. Well, you are going to be president very shortly. You are going to have at your command not just Twitter, but also the CIA, the IRS, the FBI. If you have this kind of thin-skinned vindictiveness attitude toward anybody who criticizes you, we are in very deep trouble. And, sir, so are you.
Wow. Well, Domenico, your thoughts on that and this whole brouhaha?
Well, I mean, I think Robert Reich always does have something of a flair for the dramatic. He's been able to kind of gather some attention for his points of view that way. I think Trump would probably dismiss him as just a liberal economist who's, you know, talking, saying what he's saying. And I think we should also not necessarily say exactly that we know Trump was watching when the union leader was on. I think it's very likely and perhaps apparent that he was. And I think it's important to line up some of these tweets and times. And I do think, though, Mr. Reich makes one interesting point that there are these sort of two sides to Trump. And when somebody he takes a lot of things personally. And if someone is going to who's the small guy, the little guy, yeah. really, compared to the president, going to be criticizing him, is he going to do that every day of his presidency? It seems kind of not the best use of time.
That's Domenico Montanaro, lead politics editor at NPR. Domenico, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, you don't hear this every day. A bill passed both houses of Congress with bipartisan support. Yesterday, the Senate passing the 21st Century Cures Act, which the House passed last week, and President Obama is expected to sign into law. It would, among other things, boost funding for the fight against opioid addiction, which hits 2 million Americans and is now creating addiction in newborns. A research project in San Antonio, Texas, is looking into that. Wendy Rigby of Texas Public Radio has this profile of one mother who's getting help.
The first few days of life can be a living hell for babies born to addicted mothers. They are dependent on the prescription painkillers or heroin their mothers used while they were in the womb. The withdrawal process can last days, weeks, even months. The medical term for the condition is neonatal abstinence syndrome, or NAS. Dr. Lisa Cleveland with the University of Texas Health Science Center says the symptoms are often intense.
Very high-pitched, inconsolable crying, a lot of stomach issues, so vomiting, diarrhea. These babies don't sleep well. They don't feel good.
About 400 drug-dependent babies are born in the San Antonio area each year. That's one-third of all the cases in Texas. Cleveland says it's a psychological as well as a physical problem.
The moms that we've worked with have shared stories of extreme shame and guilt for feeling that they caused this for their infant.
The drug had complete control over me.
That's 27-year-old Yolanda Aldana of San Antonio. Her addiction began after a botched epidural during the birth of her second child created back spasms and inescapable pain. The single mother was frustrated and needed help.
The doctor prescribed me Vicodin, and, you know, I kept telling him I need to take more because I feel like it's not working, and he would just prescribe me more. It was just crazy. I was by myself. You know, the drug just seemed to take everything away, like took all my pain away.
When Aldana could no longer get drugs from the pharmacy, she searched her West San Antonio neighborhood and found heroin, less expensive and more available than Vicodin. Aldana was spending more than $300 a day on her habit, first snorting, then shooting up the illicit narcotic. Eventually, she lost custody of her two daughters as she disappeared into a habit that helped her numb the pain of her complicated life.
I was a person who thought, how could people be so stupid? How could other women be so dumb to let CPS take away their kids and them not do nothing because they're on drugs?
Aldana stole from a grocery store to support her habit, landing her in jail for 8 days. That's when she found out that she was pregnant with her third child.
Going to jail was honestly like the best thing that ever happened to me.
Aldana got on methadone to quit heroin, went to rehab, and delivered her baby at San Antonio's University Hospital. That's where Lisa Cleveland recruited her for a study of kangaroo care, a holding technique where mothers put newborns on their chests, skin to skin. Studies show kangaroo care helps premature and underweight newborns thrive. But can it also help these special newborns through withdrawals?
It is one of the recommended soothing techniques for infants who have neonatal abstinence syndrome, but we really don't have any scientific evidence to show whether or not it's beneficial.
Cleveland's team monitors heart rates and the salivary cortisol levels, markers of stress in both mother and infant when they are in the kangaroo care position. She believes these NAS babies may get through their first weeks of life more easily with kangaroo care as one of the interventions.
Several of them have said they feel when their baby was skin to skin that their baby was forgiving them. And they felt that some of the shame and the guilt was going away. And so that's really powerful.
That was Aldana's experience.
It made it all better just to have her on my chest, just to have her skin to skin, just to feel her little heartbeat, for her to feel my heartbeat.
Now, what she used to say about heroin, she says about holding her baby.
It made me feel like there was no other care in the world.
Aldana is 15 months clean. She lived in a homeless shelter for a while. Now she has her own apartment. After going through so much together, she says she and her baby, Nevaeh, have an unbreakable bond. For Here and Now, I'm Wendy Rigby in San Antonio, Texas.
Two unnamed Tennessee teens have been charged with arson related to at least some of the wildfires that raged through Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge, Tennessee over the past week. The fires killed at least 14 people, injured 176, damaged more than 2,400 homes and businesses. The flames moving so quickly, swept by strong winds, that residents barely got out. Here are two of them, Rufus Searles and James Tweedle, speaking from a temporary shelter in Gatlinburg a week ago.
And on the way here, I'm telling you, on both sides of the road, it was a wall of flames. The wind was blowing 70, 80 miles an hour. The fire was blowing across the road.
You could feel the heat and the ash. I mean, the best way to describe it is like you were at the gates of hell.
Well, now, of course, cell phone videos are surfacing of what that hell was like. Michael Luciano owns Aquaflow Spa and Repair in Gatlinburg. He lives in the mountain community of Chalet Village North and barely made it down the mountain. His cell phone video is through the passenger side window. His brother-in-law is at the wheel. His dog is panting in the back seat. Flames surround them. Here's just a portion.
Please, Lord, let us get off this mountain. Oh, go, go, go. We don't need a flat right here. Tree. Go through it. Go through it.
I can't.
We cannot be stuck. Keep her in here. Oh, man. We gotta get out of here.
At this point, surrounded by flames, Michael gets out of the car to move burning tree branches. He joins us now. And Michael Luciano, given what you've been through, we appreciate you talking to us on that same cell phone because you're still out of your home. What was that like driving through fire?
It was pure devastation. I figured at first, hey, I'm just going to pull out my phone and film four or five cabins that are burning. Mine might burn down too. But once we started down the mountain, as you can see in the video, everything was on fire. The entire Chalet Village North was on fire.
Yeah. What were you thinking?
Well, a few times I didn't think we were going to make it out of there. You know, after seeing the propane tanks blowing propane, hissing, a few of the propane tanks were they actually blowed up.
Yeah.
It just pure devastation, getting stuck, having to turn back around because of a down utility pole. And then we ran into the tree. And I actually had to get out of the truck and investigate to see how much room we had to see if we could just ram through the top of the tree on the smaller branches.
How hot did it feel?
It was very hot. Inside the truck, it was extremely hot. Outside, it was even hotter. If you would have been walking down that road, you wouldn't have lasted 5 or 10 minutes. You would have died from smoke inhalation. Being on a mountain, you know, there really is no oxygen if you get down on the ground like they tell you to. Mm-hmm. On a mountain, you can't stop, drop, and roll if you catch on fire because you're going to keep rolling.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the devastation that I saw up there that night was horrific.
Yeah.
And, my prayers go out. My home didn't burn down. I'm still displaced. We're waiting for power and electric and the utilities, for the water to be reconnected. I've still got most of Wiley Oakley closed. You can go up it, but that road that I live off of, you just can't get up there right now.
Yeah.
There's just too much devastation.
Yeah. Michael, how do you feel about the news that some young people have been arrested? They're awaiting charges, but there was the possibility of somebody setting these fires.
In my village, Chalet Village North, I saw how the fires started. Earlier in the day on the way home from work, the winds were picking up. We helped a gentleman that owned a cabin. We actually pulled up on a small little fire that day, and we didn't think anything of it. Being up there, that kind of stuff happens all the time when we have high winds. But the combination with it being dry like that, we actually helped put a fire out. We own a hot tub business, and we carry water hoses in our trucks. So we grabbed a water hose, and we put that little fire out. But it had knocked the power out, and so they had to call the power company. And I also told them to call the fire company. This is all documented earlier in the day in Chalet Village that there was a small little fire up there that had to be put out.
So what are you saying? What are you saying? Do you think there was neglect here, that it wasn't addressed quickly enough? Or
if those kids were not driving around in Chalet Village setting fires, those kids did not set the fires in Chalet Village. Now, I am outraged that juveniles would go to chimney tops, and that happened on the 23rd. I am totally outraged that they would set fires purposely. And if there was any death that they should be held accountable for, they should be tried as adults. They should go to prison. This is just not right. Chimney tops did. It burned, and it burned a lot of acres. And in combination with that wind, it made it all the way to Gatlinburg. But where I live, the combination of the wind, the dry leaves, the power lines coming down, the sparks, they catch the leaves on fire, which goes to the propane tanks, gets them hot. The pressure release valve goes off, and then it's like a blowtorch. That propane tank is near that cabin. When it releases that propane, it's like a blowtorch.
Right.
It will catch that cabin on fire.
So you're...
That's what caused most of the fires in the village. Those juveniles, you know, they're not telling you the whole story. They still have to figure out who died from the fires that they actually set at Chimney Tops. What property damage was lost. They should be charged and tried. And if anyone died because they set fires, they should be fully prosecuted to the fullest extent of law. That is just outrageous what those kids did. And if they can hear me right now, shame on you. Shame on you. It's terrible what you've done. Even if you wouldn't have killed somebody, you set fires to a place that I visit, that I like to go to in my own community. It almost makes me want to cry of what you kids or juveniles, we don't even know your ages yet.
Yeah.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
Well, and we should say, I mean, I can hear your passion, but they have not been tried yet. But there are these reports, which I can hear are just enraging to you. But tell me this, Michael, what's happened to your area? I mean, you know, Gatlinburg was a sort of a, you know, second to Las Vegas for weddings. We hear that business has just ground to a halt. I mean, what's happening there?
Gatlinburg, the city. It's fine. There's still lots of good things here. And if you are coming here on vacation where you had New Year's plans or Christmas plans, don't cancel them. You know, the areas that were devastated are communities. Most of the loss of buildings and lives occurred in communities where rental cabins are at. Call your favorite cabin company. Tell them, I don't want to be in one of the affected areas where the fire was at. And chances are, you probably won't even notice the fire. They have done an excellent job of cleaning this up, and it will be cleaned up very quickly.
We are very quick to rebuild in Gatlinburg. You're saying Gatlinburg needs you now more than ever.
That is correct. Still come. We've had tons of rain. I don't see any more fires, you know, sprouting up anytime soon.
Yeah.
We didn't have rain for the longest period of time. That in combination with the high winds and the power lines in Chalet Village is what caused the fire.
Well, and Michael, just as we leave you, I mean, your thoughts about, you know, because of technology, your night of, it's just hell in those flames is now...
I had no idea that I would be filming something that would, you know, it documents and lets people know what really happened. And what the news tells you, they're not going to tell you everything. You know, it's sad what happened. And, you know, Mr. Reed's family that perished in the fire, his wife and two daughters, that made me cry that night. And, in fact, that's the first person that he flagged us down as we were coming down the mountain. And I had to break the news to him that everything's on fire. There's no chance for survival. And if you go up there, you're risking your life. and seeing the look on that man's eyes, I will never forget him crying that night. Mm. I feel so bad for that man, for losing his family. It's, and you know, the juveniles that got charged for setting fires, this just shows what fire can do. And, you know, I was worried about my home, but I didn't care at that time. I grabbed just a couple of little things. I grabbed my dad's ashes is one thing I grabbed. A couple of small little mementos within 1 minute, and we were gone.
Well, Michael Luciano, we are so glad you were gone.
Yeah, and you know, I'm just waiting to go back home. I can't wait to go and sleep in my own bed again. A lot of people, they don't have that opportunity.
Yeah.
Gatlinburg does need your support. And if you don't come, you know, it's just going to hurt the community a lot.
That's Michael Luciano. His video of his escape from the flames of the Tennessee fires is astonishing. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. Michael, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Again, we'll post it at hereandnow.org. It is heart-stopping. And our thanks to Blake Farmer of Here Now contributor WPLN in Nashville for helping us get in touch with Michael. Our best to everyone in that area.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
A lot of outrage this week after United Airlines said it will soon begin charging for use of its overhead bins. The change comes along with the company's new pricing tier, which will offer a new option called Basic Economy. They say that option could save you money, with the one drawback that you'll have to pay an extra $25 for those bags that are a little too big to fit underneath the seat in front of you. Seth Kaplan is managing partner for Airline Weekly. He joins us now. Hi, Seth.
Hey, Jeremy. Always a pleasure.
Great to have you, although under these circumstances, I don't know. But what more do we know about these changes?
Well, look, this is the trend. Unbundling, segmentation, different words basically to describe just the idea that airlines are no longer an all-you-can-eat buffet. You know, people who use more increasingly are paying more, and that includes, in some cases, even overhead bin space.
How in the world are they going to enforce that? Because some bags, you know, you put in, so are they going to lock the overhead bins so you can't get into them unless you've been authorized?
Probably not. You know, the ultra low cost carriers, as they're called, I'm talking about airlines like Spirit, Allegiant, Frontier, already do this and have been doing this for years. And basically they tell you about the rules. And if somebody sees somebody who, you know, it's indicated on their boarding card what kind of fare they have, isn't entitled to it, and they might have to pay even extra, even more at the gate than they would have paid had they booked it in advance. And that, by the way, is why United is doing this. You know, they recognize that there's a big percentage of the population that cares about price more than anything else. And, even as in some ways they've actually restored service in economy, giving free snacks and stuff like that again. On the other hand, they're saying, hey, this is a way for people who care about price more than anything else to be able to go visit grandma as inexpensively as possible if they're willing to do without certain things like a seat assignment in advance and, being able to use the overhead bin.
And is that for real, that the prices will actually be less, or is this now just going to be the basic fare and you have to pay extra?
No, I mean, you know, look, there's still going to be the standard fare that includes the overhead bin and the seat
right.
assignment, most prominently the ability to change when you fly for a fee, whereas these basic fares, you can't change it at all. I mean, it's completely non-refundable. When you add it all up, look, airlines are doing this, of course, as a way to make more money in the end, right? You know, the average person ends up paying more, but the people who pay the least rather rather do pay less with these kinds of fares than would otherwise be the case. So it goes back to what I said a minute ago, you know, the all-you-can-eat buffet, right? A good deal if you're a big eater, not a good deal if you eat like a bird. That's kind of what's happened here. You know, Southwest Airlines, very bundled, you know, bags fly free, right? But bags don't really fly free. They're included. But if you're going to check two bags, you're probably going to spend less flying Southwest. A very light packer will do a bit better with these fares or flying an airline like Spirit, one of those, than they would with a more bundled fare or on a more bundled airline.
And just a few seconds left, but do you think that American and Delta, the other big legacy carriers, are going to do the same thing United's doing?
Delta already has a basic economy fare of its own, but that offering did not exclude the overhead bin. So for Delta, it's a matter of seeing if now they match United with that specific rule. Right. American has already indicated that they, too, are going to have some kind of basic economy offering, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if it's very much like United's.
That's Seth Kaplan, managing partner with Airline Weekly. You can send your complaints to hereandnow.org. Seth, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Perhaps you've heard, Kenneth Lonergan's exquisite new film, Manchester by the Sea, is getting Oscar buzz. Casey Affleck stars as Lee, a shattered soul whose robotic life as a janitor is disrupted when his older brother Joe dies. And Joe's lawyer tells Lee he's got to come home to Manchester by the Sea to raise Joe's son Patrick, Lee's 16-year-old nephew.
I don't understand.
Which part are you having trouble with?
Well, I can't be his guardian.
Well,
I mean, I can't.
Why Lee feels he can't and what drove him from this town is revealed. We'll not be giving it away, but suffice it to say, children are lost. Kenneth Lonergan wrote and directed Manchester by the Sea and joins us from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles. Kenneth, welcome and congratulations.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
And the genesis was an idea pitched to you by Matt Damon, which was pitched to Matt by his friend John Krasinski, the actor. The idea of a man having to suddenly take care of a deceased brother's son. What pulled you in?
Just that. The idea that he had to do that and that he was also had to go home to a place he never wanted to see again because of a tragedy that drove him away. And the idea of someone dutifully trying to take care of someone else despite the emotional burden that he's carrying around.
Yeah, boy is he. And we're not going to go too far into the plot points at all, but you mentioned family tragedy. I was in the theater wondering who's making those noises during certain scenes. It was me sobbing, you know, and we feel how unbearable it was for him. How could you stay with this tragic plot point in the writing of this? How did you live with that?
Well, there's a difference between a tragedy and a piece of fiction and a tragedy in real life, as we all know. There's something I think, I don't know if I like the word cathartic, but there's something that about processing these experiences through a fictional medium that makes them engaging and I think gives you a release of some kind in some way that feels good instead of terrible. Mm-hmm. So when you're writing it, it's much the same thing. You take it seriously and you get emotional when you're working on it and you try to believe the circumstances as much as you can, but it's simply not the same thing as having it actually happen to you.
It's an incredible moment. And you underscore it with extraordinary music. The female composer, Leslie Barber, composed much of the film's score. But then there's an Adagio per archi e organo in Sol Minore by Tommaso Albinoni, a pastoral symphony from the Messiah, and He Shall Feed His Flock from the Messiah.
Feed his flock like a shepherd, and he shall gather the lambs with his arm, with his arm.
Talk about the use of this classical music against this sort of hardscrabble fishing village, blue-collar life.
Well, the music isn't meant to be a reflection of the music that the characters listen to. I think it's a reflection of the world around them in some way. It's just this very, very light, extremely exquisite, beautiful, lyrical music over these pretty, you know, some of the events are pretty serious or pretty fraught, but the whole world doesn't become fraught when you do. Mm. You can be driving along on your way to a very serious assignation of some kind, and if you're passing by the ocean is still there with the water and the light bouncing off of it, and there's something very beautiful and indifferent about nature when you're going through these things. And I think the music helps to give some of that perspective to the story.
Mm.
There's also a slight religious feeling in the sense of, you know, the universal feeling that religion can bring, and a sense of beauty on top of things that are less than beautiful. I have heard some people feel the music doesn't quite go with the story, but I don't really feel that way. I really like the music in terms of how it throws a different light on the story. It gives the film, I hope, a little perspective that it wouldn't have otherwise.
Well, you know, I disagree with those people who criticized it, because it gave these lives a majesty. You know, why not opera? You know.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it.
The New Yorker says the film burrows into the mind of a man who experiences a trauma that neither kills him nor makes him stronger, but rather leaves him maimed. Did you feel ever the pull to make him whole?
Well, I don't know how anyone becomes whole, you know, after you suffer certain losses. I think it's a little bit misleading, or a little bit, you know, it feels insincere and not respectful of the circumstances to have a happy Hollywood ending to something that you've laid out as being a very serious situation, and you're trying to find the emotional truth of it. But I will say that I think the character, you know, the more I think about the film after having made it, and I think about Casey Affleck's performance and the way we filmed it, and this is a guy who's really goes from wanting to shut out everyone to being extremely attached to his nephew, who he simply can't take care of the way they would both like him to. But by the end of the film, they're very comfortable with each other, and they're very attached to each other. And I don't feel like he's going, I don't want to ruin the ending, but it's not a big surprise ending either. This is somebody who in every scene is trying very hard to do the right thing, even with his limited equipment and even though he's suffered this terrible blow.
Talk about the ensemble that you had here. Casey Affleck, Lucas Hedges playing Patrick, Michelle Williams, Casey Affleck's ex, who also suffered that tremendous loss.
Well, I'm just lost in admiration for the cast. I think these are actors who are as fine as any actors working in the world. Casey gives a magnificent performance. You just see what he's carrying around with him without a lot of dialogue sometimes to help him express what's inside of him. And Michelle, she would just show up on the set and do these beautiful scenes and then go away and come back the next week. And Lucas is just this great young kid who's got tremendous vulnerability and emotional transparency, and also does a beautiful character turn as a scrappy hockey playing garage band strumming kid from New England when he's actually a private school kid from New York City from a theater family.
You also, of course, mentioned Michelle Williams, who plays Lee's ex-wife, who seems to be able to get in touch of some of this unbearable emotion, who seems to be someone who might somehow patch over her wound. Here's a scene between the two of them.
I know you've been around, and
just been getting Patrick settled in.
It seems like he's doing pretty good, huh, considering?
I think he is, yeah.
I guess you don't know this, but I really kept in touch with Joe. It's been kind of weird for me not seeing Patrick. I didn't know.
If you could see him if you want.
Could we ever have lunch?
You mean us, you and me?
Yeah.
Kenneth Lonergan, this isn't a quarrel, but it's a question. At this point, as an audience member, you're aching for them to please talk about what happened. And she maybe wanted to, he can't.
Yeah.
Again, you're the writer.
I had them say what I thought they would say if it was a real story. And I think they know what happened between them. They have this shared history. They're no longer together. They're not going to be together anymore. And yet they're very much still care about each other. And she's desperately trying to save him. He's really gone under. Mm. You know, it's not like they can crack open and feel better about it. It's a loss that just has to become folded into who you are eventually. And time only can heal these kinds of wounds. And they don't even, or cover them over or make them bearable. And it's not so much that I was interested in investigating the degree of pain that a person can go through, because nobody needs me to do that for them. But there are people walking around who've suffered terrible losses. And the main reason you feel such a loss so keenly is because people have such deep feelings for each other. And those are that seems to be the only thing that can save people when they've been through something like this. But I don't like the sentimental lie that you can have closure and move on and realizing that it's all one big beautiful circle of life. I don't think people feel like life is a big beautiful circle when they're really in distress. And I hope it's a worthy contribution to make a story about what it's really like to deal with some of these things. Not just how bad it is, but also how brave and loving people are under these circumstances.
That's writer-director Kenneth Lonergan. His new film is Manchester by the Sea. Kenneth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And this is some of Leslie Barber's exquisite original score. This is the Manchester by the Sea Chorale. You're listening to Here and Now.
Britain's Supreme Court today heard the final round of arguments in a case involving Brexit. A group has challenged the government, saying Parliament should have a say before Prime Minister Theresa May can trigger Article 50, which will start the process for the UK to leave the European Union. May has said she'll do that by March. Joining us from London is the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson. And Rob, this case has been going on for days. Tell us what each side is arguing.
The first thing I should say, Jeremy, is that the O.J. Simpson trial, it ain't. I mean, this is pretty dry stuff. I mean, there have been mentions along the way of King Henry VIII. He was a guy from the 16th century with six wives.
Right.
And there have been references to some obscure lobster dispute in the 19th century. But let me get to your question. What's it about? Let me make it as simple as possible. Essentially, you've got the government side saying, look, we had a referendum in June. It's blindingly obvious what the people wanted. They wanted, the government wants the vote had been taken to just get on with it and leave the European Union. The other side's argument is, hang on a minute, absolutely Britain needs to leave the European Union, but it's not for government ministers to decide that under Britain's parliamentary system. There has to be a law passed in Parliament. I hope that's clear.
Well, and when is there going to be a ruling on this?
Well, this is one of the other reasons why I don't think that the Supreme Court, entertaining and impressive and intellectually vibrant that it was, is not going to catch on as a big reality TV show, Jeremy, because you don't get the result until January. January. I mean, who heard of a show where you have to wait for the judges all that time? But that's when we'll hear.
And in the meantime, is the Brexit timetable from the Prime Minister on hold? Because she had talked about triggering Article 50 by March.
And that is still the government's hope. And I think it may be that whatever the Supreme Court rules, that probably still will be the timetable. Why do I say that? Because while it's perfectly true that if the Supreme Court decides that Theresa May is wrong and that it has to be Parliament, it has to be MPs and the House of Lords that vote on it, while they may try and dicker around with what it is that the government's trying to achieve, I mean, I get a sense that politicians in this country are incredibly fearful of the 52% who voted to get out. So I don't think politicians, no matter how dumb they think Brexit may be, I can't see them trying to hold it up. I may be wrong, but that's my hunch.
But are there people in Britain who believe that this is their way out of Brexit, that this will all play out the way that you just described, except with Parliament voting against?
I think there may be some, but my sense from watching Parliament debate this is that even those who think that Brexit is the dumbest thing that Britain has contemplated since the end of the Second World War, they don't really think it can now be stopped. I guess if we're on this issue of could anything stop Brexit, I mean, the only thing that I've heard that I suppose may have some plausibility is that if a couple of years down the road, when the process of leaving is almost completed and it looks like Britain's economy is really going to tank, maybe that would have a change of heart. But I think otherwise, even those who campaign solidly for Remain, they accept that Britain is going to leave the European Union. What the debate has become about, Jeremy, is, you know, exactly what should Britain's future relationship with the EU be?
Speaking of Britain's economy, we know that the pound has fallen significantly, but how is Britain's economy post-Brexit? Have you noticed anything different?
Well, I've certainly noticed that it's more expensive to fill my car with gas because obviously the pound has gone against the dollar and petrol is bought, gas is bought in dollars. It's really interesting you should raise this because, of course, what the Brexiteers have been saying is, oh, all you people who warned us that if we voted to leave the European Union, Britain would fall off a cliff edge, that they're saying, look, of course, that hasn't happened. But I think what Leave campaigners would point to is to say, look, actually, most of the stuff that's going on in the economy now hasn't really, it predates the actual referendum. And that if you look further down the line, there are all sorts of predictions of government revenues tanking because business will be down, the government will get less tax revenues, and that there'll suddenly be a crisis over public finances. So the short answer to your question is Brexiteers say, it was all rubbish, the economy is fine. Leave campaigners are saying you just haven't seen what's in the pipeline yet.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Rob, and that is the return of a figure who's kind of been in the background ever since he left office, Tony Blair, the former prime minister. He spoke this week to USA Today about Brexit and the Italian referendum and Donald Trump's win. Let's listen.
There is an immense amount of anger at established ways of doing things. There is a whole group of people who feel ignored by those in power. That is for sure true. And there is more anger around in politics than for a long time.
Is Tony Blair coming back into politics in the UK?
Short answer, Jeremy, no. I mean, Tony Blair is about, I'm trying to think of my own little metaphor here, he's about as popular as a hornet in a spacesuit. How about that? he could never make it as a frontline politician again. And to be fair, he's made it pretty clear that's not what he intends. But I think he does feel very passionately, as do a lot of other sort of semi-retired senior politicians, that the debate in Britain has become very nasty, very populist on both the right and the left, that it's for people like him to try and do what they can to influence the debate and to cry out for that most difficult of cries, what do we want? Moderation. When do we want it? Soonish, please.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, joining us from London. Rob, thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
A hornet in a spacesuit. That would not be good. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.